Genesis chapter 2, if you would please, gentlemen. Genesis chapter 2. And one of the problems with missing a week in between is that it kind of takes some of the momentum away. So hopefully I can recapture some of that this morning as we consider this chapter again. Now, you remember my structure for this study is a week in which we gather and talk about the questions and have a dialogue. And then the second week is to go back and to lecture through this material and summarize and try to draw it all together, make some larger sense out of it. The problem with a discussion group sometimes is that it goes off into the weeds and you kind of lose track sometimes of where things are at. So my goal in the lectures is to bring these things together, hook them together with what we've already seen, and get us ready for what is to come. So, and I use the questions as my outline for this. So I just basically going to follow the same order. So if you didn't have an answer to a question along the way, hopefully I'll provide one. I don't necessarily answer every question directly in the lecture, but try to at least touch on each point that's being made. In Genesis chapter 1, the author of this book, whom I'm assuming to be Moses, writes a description of God's creation of all things in a sort of generic or general sense. He doesn't write a specific science manual about how everything was created, but rather steps back and flies over it at a high level to say God created. I mean, the fundamental message of Genesis 1 is God created all things, and everything comes from him, including every aspect of the creation, everything that's needed to create it, as well as all of what is created, as well as the fact that mankind sits at the pinnacle of that creation. So in Genesis 1, you have this sort of overview of creation. But now, as you turn into chapter 2, what Moses attempts to do now is to retell the story of the creation of humanity from a more detailed perspective. It was kind of a fad several years back. I think it's faded now, but there was a fad going around in some Christian circles that the Genesis accounts were actually two separate accounts, two different creation stories, as though Genesis 1 existed at some time past, and then Genesis 2 was another creation account that began sometime later. And then there was a gap in between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. That's sort of fallen out of favor amongst scholars today. Most are willing to admit now that Genesis 2 is simply a retelling of the same or some of the parts of Genesis 1, but in a much more detailed perspective. And of course, when you look at Genesis 2, what you have is a retelling of the creation of humanity specifically. I mean, the very specific thing that you get out of this chapter is that God didn't just create humanity, but God intimately created humanity. There's something very special about how God formed this creature called man. And the distinctions and the differences are important because they lay the groundwork for what's going to take place in Genesis 3. And so as we turn to Genesis 2, we're turning to a look at how God formed humanity specifically. Now, the chapter starts with a quick shot by Moses of what the world is like at this particular point. You can imagine Moses pausing here and thinking, okay, everything's is ready, everything is done. The condition of the earth is in its pristine state. God has formed now every substantive matter. And at the beginning of the chapter, it even goes so far as to move to the seventh day, even beyond the sixth day, to say what God had done is he had formed everything well and perfectly, and then he rested on the seventh day. So what you have is a picture of the earth here that's being painted, even all the way down through verse 9. You have a picture of a world which I think the best way to describe it is a world in a state of non-growth, a world in a state of stasis, nearly, a situation in which God had formed all things, and had determined that all things would in fact grow and reproduce, but the impetus for that growth would be the final created matter, which is human beings. So the world is not complete without human beings there. It requires the existence of man in order for it to begin to do the work that's supposed to be done. Notice how he writes verse 5. When no bush of the field was yet in the land, and no small plant of the field had yet sprung up, for the Lord had not caused it to rain in the land, and there was no man to work the ground, and a mist was going up from the land and was watering the whole face of the ground, then the Lord God formed man. Okay, so those two verses, 5 and 6, are designed to say, okay, here's the state of the creation at this point. Everything's there. It's all in place. But it's not in motion yet. It's sort of in a state of stasis. This idea of no bush of the field and no small plant cannot mean that God hadn't yet created plants, because we know from the account that plants are created even earlier in the creation account than the sun and the moon and the stars. So it cannot mean that the earth is some sort of flat, barren, desert-like place. What it probably means is that the idea of cultivation has not yet begun. And let's not forget that Moses is writing to an agrarian society. He's writing to a group of people who understand nothing but farming. You know, we don't. We live in a completely different age. I mean, anybody here in this room a farmer? At least where I came from, we had farmers. I mean, they understood the concept. They were out in their fields every day, tilling the soil, planting seeds, praying for rain, and hoping that it would produce a crop. You know, to pray for rain around here, but they did in Kansas. So they understand this concept of the Israelites wandering in the wilderness, waiting to go into the promised land, would have understood this. They would have understood the concept of a promised land being a place where they would go and establish themselves and cultivate crops and grow food and make a living, subsist. And so when they're reading this, they would read this as, okay, it's not growing. It's not reproducing. It needs someone to till the soil. It needs someone to plant the seeds. It needs someone to help in the process. And you remember that, as we talked about a couple of times now, that God had created the world and given it that command to reproduce, to multiply. And yet, what Moses says here is because no man had been formed to work the ground. So notice the connection of cultivation and reproduction to the existence of mankind. So Moses is starting from the perspective of here you have this clean slate, what in Latin circles is called a tabula rasa. It's blank. It's a blank slate. And now God is going to create the being who is going to make all of this come to life, which is why we who are Christians have a Christian worldview in which we understand that this world isn't just some place that we live. We have an interconnectedness to the very essence of creation itself. There's a sense amongst those who have a non-Christian worldview that this world would be better off without us. If humanity were to disappear. There was a show on some years ago was called After Man or something like that. It was on one of those, you know, so-called learning channels. And the idea of the show was what it would be like if human beings were to just instantly disappear from this planet. And they would take some particular aspect of the world and they would show what would happen after a few minutes and a few hours and a few days and a few years and a few centuries. And, you know, the basic point of the show was, if we could just get rid of humanity, then the earth would go back to its pristine condition. But a Christian worldview says, no, the world was created in such a way that it needs human beings in order for it to flourish and be what it was created to be. So that's completely upside down from the way the world is. And, of course, the reproduction issue, of course, is the whole idea that, well, if humans would stop reproducing, the world would be in better shape, right? Because we wouldn't have overpopulation and pollution and all these other things, which are probably true as a result of the fall. but fails to take into account the reality that the world was created to be a place for human beings to not only occupy, but to actually bring to its potential. So the agent of dominion, the agent of reproduction, is humanity, specifically through the work of cultivation. Okay, so the idea of this state then is, here's a world that has all the potential, but has not yet got the creature who will come and bring that to it. Okay, now go to verse 7 then. It says, then the Lord God. Okay, so now, as a result of this, here's the condition. Then God forms man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. Now, that's a very important statement. If I could correct one misconception of the modern church, it would be from these verses. And the misconception is a form of Gnosticism that has entered into the thinking of most Christians, that we are creatures that are fundamentally spiritual in nature. And what Moses wants to make clear is that we are fundamentally physical in nature. Notice how this goes. Adam is not created ex nihilo. He is not formed from nothing. God just doesn't say, let there be a man. Boom, a man appears. Nope. This is God actually entering into his own creation in some sort of way. Let's assume that this is a theophany of some sort in which God appears in human form and he steps into the very world that he's created, and it says that he takes dust from the ground and he forms the dust into the shape of a man. Now notice what's created first. It's the body. It's the physical, corporeal nature of the creature called humanity that's built first, not the spirit aspect of him. You can almost imagine there's a moment in which God has formed this Adam from the ground. He has shaped it. He has given it all the various things that it needs, the organs and the outward appearance and the outward structure, skeletal structure, nervous system, circulatory system, everything it's going to need. But it's not living yet. It's just this thing. It's a body without life in it. It has no natural life in it, but it's the first thing created. Again, what many Christians today want to think is, well, if we could just escape from the body, then life would be better. Mm-hmm. And of course, the justification is, well, the body is always racked with pain and limitation and suffering of all kinds and so forth, and we have to feed it, and we have to breathe, and we have to, you know, put medicines in it to keep it going, and we have to exercise. Well, we don't have to, but we ought to. You know, I mean, the list goes on and on, right? So for many Christians, it's like, if I could just escape this body and get out of it, then everything would be better. And the fact is, that's not the case. What I learned from these two verses is that God formed us first as physical beings. And we are human because we are physical beings. We were formed to be human. We were not formed to be angels. We were not formed to be animals, but we were not formed to be angels either. We were formed in a very distinct, intimate, unique way that has a body. And that is why, by the way, the doctrine of the resurrection is so very important. Again, the resurrection has almost gone from Christian eschatology today. The idea of us actually being taken up from the ground and reconstituted bodily and brought back to life physically is unheard of in Christian circles. I mean, you can go to funerals and not even hear about it nowadays, of all things. The resurrection of the body is an essential element of what it means to be human, because we were created to be physical by nature. Now, the good news, of course, is that this fallen body that we have, this physical condition, will be replaced by a glorified one in some future state. But make no mistake about it, we will always be corporal creature beings with eyes, ears, noses, tongues, kidneys, livers, etc. Now, I'm hoping that in the glorified state, all those things work perfectly together forever, okay, without pain and suffering and struggles, and you'll be out of a job. Okay? That's what I'm hoping. But you'll be happy about that, because I'm sure we'll find you another job. But the point is that the body is an essential element. And the other thing to keep in mind here is that this body wasn't just formed by God willy-nilly. It was intimately created. This is God taking dust from the ground himself, personally, forming it. The word forming is being used here in most translations. God formed man. He took a picture from his mind of what he wanted you and I to look like and shaped it and sculpted it, if you will, into what he wanted it to be, what he wanted it to look like. So it's not accidental that our heart is slightly offset in our chest, etc. These things are the way God purposed it, because he had a perfect plan in mind for that. I'm going to go way out on a limb here and suggest that the image of God that he had in forming Adam from the dust of the ground was the picture of his own son who would one day come and enter into that flesh. As a part of his eternal decree, God had purposed that his son would enter into this creation and become a man, and the form, shape, substance, and look of the creature was what he and his son had covenanted together to be in time and space. And so God forms Adam in the shape of Christ. Now, I don't have any proof of that scripturally, and that sounds kind of upside down, right? But if we understand God to be a God who's decreed all things before he does it, then we must assume that he has some sort of advance idea of what his son would be doing as a part of this eternal covenant that he and the son established to redeem a human race. Therefore, doesn't it not seem reasonable to assume that the race itself looks like what he had envisioned for his son long before he even created? And I would even go so one step further than that. I would even argue that this is the Son himself forming this man. That it's the Son who comes down from his heavenly abode in a theophanous form and enters into this world and takes dust from the ground and forms it into the shape of that which he himself would take on in a few thousand years.
Never thought about that, because the body has to be, body is laid out a certain way.
That's right.
For the maximum suffering of the crucifixion.
There you go. So it's very reasonable to assume then that
suffering.
Right, the creature being created is being created to match that which would eventually be needed in redemption. Now again, I can't prove that from Scripture. I can just do a little sanctified speculation there. But I think that it's a reasonable conclusion to say that what you have is a physical being now who looks like what Christ will look like eventually, because he takes on that form. Nonetheless, even if it's not, even if that's not the case, God still forms this creature intimately from the dust of the ground. And then it says he breathes into the creature and he becomes a living being. He becomes now a creature possessing a nature that flows directly from the nature of God himself. The idea of a breath flowing out is that part of God that flows out of him into the creature. Now again, this is not deity flowing from God into the creature. This is the God-like attributes, dare I say God-like attributes that flow out of the character of God and into the creature as God had envisioned the creature to possess. Now you remember, back in chapter 1, we're told, according to verse 26, that man was created in the image of God. Now I would start with the physical nature is the first part of that image. That's the visible one. That's the one that God sees when he forms this creature from the ground. But now there's the part of the image of God that's what less seen, but yet still very visible. It's what we in Latin call the Imago Dei. This is the image of God that has been imparted into us. Now, this is very important as well, because this distinguishes human beings from every other created being. And I would argue even from angels. Notice angels possess many of the image of God characteristics, thought, language, will, etc., reason, right? We know that Satan had a will. He chose to turn away from the things of God. So even angels are created with certain godlike attributes. The one they're missing is their physical nature. They're corporeal. They're not corporeal beings. One could argue that us as corporeal beings are a step higher than angels because we possess something angels don't have. You could make that argument. Nonetheless, the Imago Dei is that nature of God that's inculcated in us by virtue of being formed directly by Him, by God breathing directly into us and being brought to life through the process of God breathing into us. We possess various higher characteristics of humanity that are not present in the animal world. They're clearly visible in the character and nature of God, and thus they are available or visible in us. Now, our problem, of course, is that we cannot know what that image looked like in Adam prior to the fall, because every aspect of the Imago Dei has been corrupted by the fall. But we still possess it in some measure. And what we will have in our glorified state then is the perfect version of the Imago Dei again in us that will be recaptured, or glorified is the theological term that will come back to us, which is what we're looking forward to, is that day of glory. But there are many aspects to this Imago Dei. Of course, right off the bat, we think of things like intellect, reason, you know, the ability to logically think, orderly, rational thought, emotion, the ability to emote, the ability to react and respond. For example, the ability to love and the ability to hate, although I would argue that love and hate are not emotions, but I'll put them in that category for now. The ability to respond to things that we see with a sense much higher. For example, you can look at a great piece of art and be moved by it. How do you explain that? It's hard to explain what that is, but it's part of that nature of God in us. We have, of course, will. Volition is the better word. The ability to make rational decision and choose between different perspectives. And we have the ability to make thoughtful choice. We have the ability to actually sit down with a piece of paper, for example, and write out the pros and the cons, the reasons why and the reasons why not. Very often we make decisions without even thinking about them, of course. We make a lot of decisions without ever thinking about them. Have you ever had one of those situations where you've been driving down the freeway and all of a sudden you sort of wake up and go, I just went 20 miles and I have no idea how I did that, because your mind is off somewhere else, okay? You're making a myriad of decisions even without even rationally, consciously thinking about them. You have that ability that comes from God, the ability to separate even on multiple tracks. I think, for example, about the fact, I tell people all the time that when I'm sitting in my office listening to something on my computer, like a sermon or a blog or something like that, I play solitaire. And the reason that I do is because it occupies the conscious portion of my mind so that my mind doesn't wander off. I play something, you know, mindless, if you will, on the computer, and it actually heightens my ability to think. So when you see people in the congregation that are doodling or they're playing a game on their phone, they're probably listening better than the average person sitting there thinking, now, did I go to Wendy's twice yesterday? So what you have is an ability to think. You have a massive rational ability in us. We have self-awareness and consciousness. I often hear people talk about animals as sentient beings. They're not! We are sentient beings. We are self-aware creatures. We are capable of analyzing ourselves, thinking about ourselves. We're able to analyze our own reactions to things and think about, well, now, why did I think that? Or why did I say that? Or why did I do that? You know, we have the ability to think like that. We have the ability to even understand our own weaknesses. We have the ability, for example, to examine our own ways of doing things, our own emotional patterns and so forth. They call it psychology, but we have the ability to actually contemplate ourselves and understand our defects, if you will, personality-wise, etc. Which, by the way, we have personality. We have a uniqueness of personhood in the sense that everybody's unique in their personality. We have different ways of responding to things. Every one of us laugh at different things. Some people think some things are funny, and other people look at it and go, that's not funny. And so a comedian, for example, has to find the widest possible audience in his jokes in order to make a living. Because there's some comedians that have just very niche groups that they can make laugh. Everybody else thinks they're gross. Mm-hmm. Okay? And that's part of the Imago Dei in us. We have this ability to be self-aware. We have the ability to consider our own mortality, for example. The ability to think about death. To contemplate death. To contemplate the idea of dying. To try to understand the concept of unconsciousness, etc. I mean, we can float those ideas around in our head. It's difficult to think of non-existence, for example. It doesn't add up, does it? But we have the ability to contemplate that as a possibility, right? I think, therefore I am, right? We have the ability to consider ourselves more than just our physical bodies. And going back to the point that I made earlier about us being created as human beings, we are so intimately connected of all those Imago Dei aspects to us, to our physical nature, that it's very hard to tell where they start and end. I can give you an example. Have you ever had a paper cut? Little tiny paper cut on your finger, and it occupies your entire mind for the next hour. Everything else seems to fade into existence. Right? Non-existence. It's like that little tiny little cut on your finger occupies you. Or you hit your finger with a hammer and you spend the next hour, you know, sucking your thumb and groaning around, moaning, looking for a bag of peas to put on it, you know, frozen peas to kind of help you. Notice the intimate connection between the physical and the non-physical, which is, by the way, the reason why death is such an enemy, because it rips that apart. We have consciousness. We have conscience. We have morality and ethics. The ability to understand the difference between what is right and what is wrong. Adam knew that it was wrong to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He possessed that naturally. God told him not to do so, but he was able to rationally consider it. Okay, if I eat from the tree, I'm going to die. If I don't eat from the tree, I'm going to live. I don't know what death is yet, but I understand the concept. And so there's an ability for us to consider what is good and what is evil. And even the most evil person that has ever existed possesses certain ethical realities in them towards good. I mean, I've often said Adolf Hitler probably loved his mother. I mean, he may have been the most evil person that ever lived. No, he really wasn't. I mean, there were probably others like Stalin or Pol Pot or others that were probably a lot worse than Hitler. But he's the guy, right, that we kind of point to now as the epitome of evil. He probably loved his mother. He understood the difference between good and evil. He understood that. He purposed to go one way rather than another because he was totally corrupt in his mind. But nonetheless, he understood it. Even the worst, even Satan himself knows the difference between good and evil. I mean, when he tempted Jesus in Matthew 4, he understood what would be the right choice, right? We possess language. We have communicative abilities, the ability to communicate with one another, not just verbally, as we talked a couple of weeks ago, the ability to communicate with each other in a whole lot of different ways. I said on Wednesday night, we get the look from our wives, right? You didn't have to say anything, and we know exactly what she's thinking. We can look at a child's face and know exactly what they're thinking. And you can communicate all kinds of things with your face or your hands or whatever. Your body language, for example, tells me a great deal. I know when you've gone bored from your body language. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to tell me, I know.
Looking out the door from the traffic.
Yeah, right, looking out the window. Hey, where are they going? So we have the ability to communicate in both written and verbal forms. We have artistic ability. We've had the ability to create culture of all kinds. Imagine this world without culture. Well, you can't, because it's an intimate part of who we are. People gather together in their little groups, their little tribes, and they produce a culture in that tribe. The culture of the South and East is much different from the culture in the North and West. And you feel very much out of place in Seattle as a Southerner, right? It's very different. But it's a culture. We have the ability to create that, to form that. So God has given to us all of these God-like attributes. Now, I realize there are rudimentary forms of them in the animal kingdom, in the sense that animals have the ability to make choices. But they're not making choices based on rational thought. They're typically making choices based on pure instinct or some other function that we don't understand yet. But human beings are distinct from the animal world in the ability to reason, the ability to contemplate, to distinguish. In other words, human beings are more than the sum of their parts. We aren't just a body and a mind. We are a creature that's formed into this thing that if you take out all the parts and try to put it back together again, you can't form it. Which is one of the reasons, by the way, why there is such a fascination today with robotics and artificial intelligence and what's the other term I'm looking for? Well, anyways, the fascination with artificial intelligence is the idea of, could we take the uninnate part of us, the permanent part of us, the immortal part of us, and put it into something else? Could we take the mind and, you know, the consciousness of a person, if you will, and stick it into a robot? And the answer is no! Because there is such an intimate connection between body and soul, body and spirit, that there's no way to disconnect those two things. You're never going to be able to take all of someone's memories, for example, and implant them into a robot, and that robot is going to be you. It'll never be. That'll never happen. Now, again, the reason why unbelievers pursue that is because that's the extent of their worldview. The body is going to fall back to the ground, and they know it. And so I've somehow got to keep this part of me that I know exists within me going. Okay. So, in other words, we have this ability. And when we turn to chapter 3, we will see that it is corrupted in the fall. All right. Now, as I said a moment ago, the conditions of the earth are formed in a shape in which it's ready for growth. It's not yet there. But then it says in verse 8, the Lord God planted a garden in Eden. Notice the garden is not named Eden in the verse. The garden is in Eden, which seems to imply to me that Eden is a bigger place than just the garden. Eden may be the entire region or area. I don't know. Okay. But God forms this garden, and it says he puts the man whom he had formed in the garden, and out of the ground the Lord God made to spring up every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. The tree of life was in the midst of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was there. Okay, so this is a garden that's idyllic. It has everything needed for human life. It was also everything that would be useful to man. Notice verse 10. Rivers are flowing out of Eden to water the garden. Okay, notice the distinction here between Eden and the garden. There's rivers flowing out of Eden into the garden. The mistake that many of us make is assuming the garden was named Eden. No, there's a place called Eden. There have been some scholars who suggested that Eden is actually the name of the planet as a whole, and the garden is just one place within this whole that's in this whole place. The only way, I mean, it's really hard to understand what Moses is speaking of here. And part of the problem, of course, is that it's gone. It's gone because God erased it from the earth. And he did so when? At the flood. He wiped it out. So you have these rivers, and he gives them names, and there's four of them. And then in verse 12, it says, and the gold of the land is good. Bdellium and onyx stone are there. We're not sure what bdellium is, but probably some sort of precious metal or precious stone that's available there. The name of the second river is there, Gihon, and so on and so on. And we can locate this area, by the way, because at least two of these rivers survived. Mm-hmm. the Tigris and the Euphrates, of course, became Lower Mesopotamia, otherwise known as modern Iraq, where a civilization began, the cradle of humanity, if you will. Okay, so this is a garden that's formed, it's idyllic, it's perfect. And the other thing to keep in mind is that it says here that it's got like stuff like gold and bdellium and onyx, and the implication being other things as well. What is the point of those? The point is that God didn't just create a garden to provide for the sustenance of Adam, but God also created a garden for the luxury of Adam, for the ability of Adam to take his image of God, that image of God in him, and actually be creative himself. He can't create ex nihilo, but he can create from pre-existing material. And so he can take gold and form it. He can take bdellium, whatever it is, and turn it into something. He can take onyx stones and use them. And you think about it, that's exactly what we have done. We have taken out of this earth an unbelievable number of things and created a massive amount of stuff from what's just in the ground. You walk into a typical Walmart, mm-hmm. and you just look around. Next time you walk into Walmart, just do this. Look around at the variety of stuff that's in that store. Every single thing that's in that store came out of the earth in some way or form. Mm-hmm. It was formed from some substance of the earth. We've had remarkable creative ability to turn oil, for example, into an unbelievable number of things. And so the bottom line is that God didn't just give Adam a garden just with the necessary things to subsist, but he gave him everything that he would be able to enjoy to form and create and build and bejewel himself and so on. Everything imaginable. Now, you know, of course, according to verse 5 and verse 15, that Adam is to work in this garden, mm-hmm. to cultivate the plants, keep the garden functional, orderly. Now, we know that death has not yet come, so we don't really have a way of understanding how this work would have worked, pardon the pun, during that time. We know that there were no weeds, there were no hindrances, there was nothing that would get in the way of Adam being able to do his job. So, but yet he had to work. Now, again, I connect that back to the cultivation reality of the earth needing man in order to explode in growth. And so whatever it is that Adam's doing, he is the catalyst that's causing the earth to now spring forth with all of its life. Maybe he taught the animals how to procreate. I don't know. I mean, that's what farmers do. If you've ever been on a ranch, this is what they do, okay? So it's maybe, I don't know, I'm speculating, right, that Adam is doing all this stuff, and he's causing the earth now to come to its purpose and intention, or its potential is now being raised up by Adam being in this place. So the garden needed Adam to work it. It's not that the garden lacked something per se. I mean, that's not a good way to say it. It's rather to say that it sat there with its potential until man came along to exert his creative actions over it to cause it to then grow. So you have God creating, and then you have man creating. As part of the Imago Dei, we are very creative creatures. Okay, so that's it. Now, we know that there were two special trees placed in this garden. One was forbidden, the other was allowed. Of course, we have the tree of life, which was not forbidden. There's no indication in this text that they were not allowed to eat from the tree of life. It seems reasonable to conclude that they would have thus eaten from the tree of life and continued their subsistence. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, however, has a different purpose. Its purpose is to make a distinction. And I am convinced that this tree was established in the garden to create something. And what it created was choice, moral choice. Without the tree, everything else being unforbidden, there becomes no distinction of moral choice. So the tree of the knowledge of good and evil becomes the distinct element by which God then exercises in Adam and eventually Eve, he exercises the reality of moral choice. So in the Imago Dei, Adam possessed the ability to distinguish between good and evil. Now he has a choice between good and evil. And I would argue that God also has a choice between good and evil. He's not prohibited from doing evil. He simply cannot by virtue of his nature. But he must have an ability to decide between what is good and what is not. For in chapter 1, we hear that God created, and then what did he call it? Good. So he's able to distinguish what is good from what is not good. Now again, we're not God, and let's not speculate how God operates in this realm. But what we can assume is that given the fact that we can make such distinctions, we must assume that God can as well. Therefore, the tree becomes the very source or the very impetus or the very center of a true distinction between what is good and what is evil. So there it stands, and Adam is given a choice. Now, of course, as an infralapsarian, of course, I'm under the impression or belief that God placed that tree there specifically for the purpose of Adam eating from it. It wasn't just for it to sit there and for Adam to just have some sort of natural, unhindered moral choice. I'm inclined to believe that because God had already decreed to send his son to redeem a people, he had purpose for Adam to eat from the tree, although he did not cause Adam to eat from the tree. Okay, so my superlapsarian friends would see it slightly differently, but that's okay. In verse 18, it says, "And the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone." Now, man is not alone. Man has God, the ultimate relationship. But God recognizes that man must also have a relationship that is equal to himself. And this again flows from the Imago Dei. God has within his own nature a perfect relationship of kind. For the Father and the Son and the Spirit as co-eternal, co-equal persons within the single being of God have relationship. The Father and the Son and the Spirit have had an intimate and perfect relationship for all eternity. Therefore, the Imago Dei given to man thus places within man a natural desire to have a relationship with a being similar to himself. Just as the Father and the Son and the Spirit are similar to one another, I'll put that in quotes, similar, thus Adam possesses a natural desire to relate to someone else. And I would argue, and I think I have every country song in the world to prove it, that human beings desire relationship. Mm-hmm. Right? They want relationship. They need it. They crave it. Even the worst introvert in the world will go insane being left in solitary confinement for too long. The fact of the matter is that we are built to have relationship. And so God says it's not good for man to be alone, so I'll make a helper fit for him. Now, before he makes a helper, God brings all of the animals to Adam. And there's two purposes for that. One is to name them. Now, again, let's not forget, as I've said many times, that the name of a being matches the nature of the being. We don't do this as much anymore as even ancient Israelites did, where the name of someone is connected to their character, okay? I mean, the name of Jacob, right? What does it mean?
Deceiver.
Okay, so what did he do to his brother? Cheated him, okay? So names relate to something. Yahweh, I am, means something. God is the I am. He is self-existent. He is self-determining, right? God doesn't need anything outside of himself. So he's self-existing. His nature as living is living because he is. I am, he says. So names mean something. So all these animals that come to Adam are brought by God in order for Adam to describe their nature, to establish them. That's an elephant, and that's not. That's a platypus. There's a distinction between the two creatures. And by the way, even my just using the words in front of you distinguished between the two creatures in your mind, didn't it? Mm-hmm. There's no confusion on your part of the difference between an elephant and a platypus. Even though I didn't show you a picture of them, you know the difference between the two. So that's one. But the other is to seek from within the animal world a helper or a partner for Adam, right? Notice the end sentence of verse 20. But for Adam, there was not found a helper fit for him. There wasn't one found. Because there was no creature of all the creatures that were brought to him. I'm not exactly sure how God brought all the fish to him. But I imagine there must have been a way. And so God brought all the insects and all the animals and all the fish and all the birds in front of him. And he looked at all those creatures and he said, none of these are useful. Why? What's missing? The Imago Dei is missing. What's missing from all those creatures is they don't possess the ability to relate to Adam in that natural sense. Now, I know you love your dog or your cat. I get it, okay? And many people have an inordinate affection towards their pets. Okay, I get it. But the pet will never relate to you in the same way as a spouse will. And there's a lot of people, for example, that lose their spouse and then they get a cat and they have that cat, but they still pine for the spouse because the cat can never replace the spouse. The reality is that none of the animals were able to provide that innate sense of similarity that would allow them to relate. And, of course, the obvious example is that none of the creatures could speak to Adam, save one. And that one, when he spoke, didn't say good things. So we'll get to that in chapter 3. But the reality is that no animal could come to him and speak to Adam and have a rational conversation with him and argue with him and laugh with him and so forth. They didn't exist. So God needed to form another creature that would be equal to Adam. So that's why he forms Eve. Verse 21, the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man. He was the first anesthesiologist. And while he slept, took one of his ribs, closed up its place with flesh, and the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. So he creates a being from the original being. Now notice again, it's not an ex nihilo creation. Okay? And it's not God going and getting some more dust from the ground and forming another creature. This creature, this second creature, is created from the same material as the first is created. So all the DNA of the man transfers to the woman. And yet God, when he takes the rib, he takes just a part of Adam and he forms a creature that's a little different from the man. He forms a creature that's a woman. And notice how Adam speaks of it in verse 23. This at last is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. In other words, this is a creature that looks like me and thinks like me and sounds like me and so forth. Although the fall pretty much erased all that. Yeah. Women don't think like men anymore. Sorry. I'm going to have to edit that out of the recording, aren't I? This at last is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. This at last is a creature who's just like me that I can relate to and yet is different from me, which allows me to really relate to her. Okay, that's the thing to keep in mind. It's one of the reasons why homosexuality is an utter violation of the Imago Dei. It's not just a violation of certain sexual norms. It's a violation of the Imago Dei. Because the Imago Dei says, I want to relate to a being who is like me, yet is different from me. Just as the father is different from the son, so the man is different from the woman. It's not three fathers in the Trinity. It's a father, a son, and the spirit. They are distinct persons with distinct personalities. They possess the same being, substance, but they have different personalities. The Father is not the Son, the Son is not the Spirit, etc. Same thing here. Adam and Eve are two distinct creatures, similar to one another, in other words, bearing the same being, same nature, and yet being distinct, just as the Father and the Son are of the same nature, and yet are distinct. See the parallel? So, that's why Adam needed someone else. He needs someone different from himself. This would have been an awful boring world. If I could justify the existence of women here for a moment. This would have been an awful boring world if it was just made out of men. Mm-hmm. And we all looked alike. What's the point of that? Right? It's that distinction between man and woman that makes this world go round. I don't care how you cut the pie. Again, I give you every country song that's ever been written, okay? Which, by the way, if you play a country song backwards, you get your wife back, you get your car back, you get your dog back. Okay. So, God creates a creature that's similar yet different. She shall be called woman, which is a form of the word Adam, different in Hebrew, but similar. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. There's a distinct nature relationship between them that's being satisfied by virtue of being similar in form and yet distinct in form as well. So when we talk about when we talk about the distinction between men and women, we're not just saying, well, you have two distinct creatures. No, you have a creature created in the image of God, both bearing the image of God, similar yet distinct. And that's what makes relationship, real relationship, happen. And by the way, in case you didn't know this, most homosexuals rarely have monogamous relationships. The idea of a single monogamous homosexual relationship is almost unheard of. Homosexual men have multiple partners over their lives. Very rarely do you ever find single relationships because it doesn't work. It's not part of how we were created. It doesn't fit. The distinction is important. Okay? The distinction is important. So what we have in this relationship then, of course, is the first truly human interaction, fulfilling the intimate relational need within the Imago Dei that's inherent to Adam. But we also have the first marriage relationship. Now, it's implied. It's not stated outright, is it? But it is implied. God brings the woman to the man, so now they have a first human marriage relationship. And this human relationship of man and woman forms the basis of a new entity from which family springs. This new entity is this single flesh relationship that exists between a husband and a wife, in which the two become one. And that oneness is a new creature. In fact, I heard one scholar once say that when God created Adam and Eve, he had two distinct creatures. And then when he brought them together, he had a third. Father, Son, Spirit. There's a Trinitarian view here. A man and a woman. Two distinct things come together to form a third. So when the preacher stands and says, I now pronounce you husband and wife, he's creating something new. Something new is formed there. It's one of the reasons I love doing weddings, because I get the privilege of standing in front of this two person, these two people, and creating something new that has never existed before and can never be torn away, according to God. And so it is this marriage relationship that produces this new being, but it's this new third being, this husband and wife relationship, that is the foundation of human civilization. It is, of course, the foundation of human reproduction, right? So it's the foundation of the dominion statement from Genesis 1, in which man and woman procreate to create little versions of themselves, which go out and procreate and create more little versions of themselves, and so forth. So in other words, the creative process continues, but it's from that that human civilization comes. You read on in this book, we get into chapters 4 and 5 and beyond, what we will see is it is the procreation of human beings spreading out throughout the earth that produces culture, language, and artistic endeavor, and so forth, formed out of that basis. But it's the very basis of human civilization. The reason why Western civilization, as we know it now, is in deep trouble is because Western civilization has abandoned the most foundational element under itself, You want to know why Western Europe is collapsing? Because the birth rate in Western Europe has fallen below two. They're not even replacing themselves at this point. I mean, a husband and wife that have two children, right? All they're doing is replacing themselves. They're not actually expanding the race. Because eventually mom and dad are going to die and all that's left are two kids. So they're not actually increasing themselves. But when the birth rate falls below two, guess what happens? The race begins to contract. And when you add unfettered abortion to the equation, you've lowered that even further, which means now Western civilization is crumbling, and we shouldn't wonder why. We brought it upon ourselves because we have failed to understand the Christian worldview, which is that the very foundation of human civilization is the imago Dei in man and woman taking dominion over the earth and reproducing. That's how civilizations survive. It's how they were created. It's how they survive. In Matthew chapter 19, verses 3 through 6, Jesus quotes from the passage in Genesis 1, 27, God creating man in his own image. And he's answering a question. And the question that comes to him involves human sexuality. In the case of that, it's about divorce. But fundamentally, Jesus answers the question about human relationship. What Jesus does in this passage is he answers every question that's ever been raised about human sexuality, and that is, what is considered an appropriate human sexuality? And the answer is, one man and one woman in a lifetime, covenantal, monogamous, child-bearing relationship. That is the foundation of all human sexuality. Everything else is a perversion of it. Everything else is the result of the fall. And so Jesus may never have talked about homosexuality directly. I'll grant you that. But in this particular passage, he talked about every form of sexuality by saying, listen, this is what God intended from the beginning. A man and a woman coming together to create this new creature, reproducing themselves, and this is the foundation of human civilization. If you change that, you mess with the created order. You threaten its very existence. I said that we can find the gospel of Jesus Christ in every chapter of this book. Chapter 1 is pretty easy to find because we know that God created all things and established all things as good and perfect and right. And thus, we know that redemption is built around the idea of God coming to remake that which he created. But it's even more visible in chapter 2. I would argue that chapter 3 has the easiest way to find the gospel, but chapter 2 is right behind it. In chapter 2, what we have is a picture of God creating a being formed in his own image, intimately formed in his own image, established to be a creature possessing all of the godlike attributes he wished to give to it, establishing it in a world that was built for it, so that this race of creatures would have a perfect world in which to live, a perfect being in themselves, and then a perfect relationship in which he then takes this being and forms a second complementary version of itself into this world. And here you have this perfect existence of a creature in perfect harmony with its creator, in perfect harmony with one another, and perfect harmony with the creation that's been created. That, my friends, is the foundation of the gospel itself, because the gospel is about getting that back. Restoring that. Jesus Christ did not come to this world just to make sure you go to heaven when you die. Because frankly, where you go when you die and after the resurrection is back to a new heaven and a new earth. Again, we're corporal beings. We're physical beings. We're going to enjoy a planet that I would argue is better even than what the picture we have here. God's going to perfect it even more than what he gave to Adam. And our glorified condition is going to be even better than what he gave to Adam in the first place. But that's what redemption is. To get it all back. Paul alludes to that in Romans when he says that all creation is groaning, waiting for its day of redemption, waiting for the sons of men to be revealed. What's it waiting for? It's waiting for the elect from every tribe, tongue, and nation to be revealed. And when that list is complete, then the trump will sound and Christ will come and he'll blow away this worthless, sin-filled, decrepit, and destroyed world and build a new one. Recreate a new, perfect one. And we will get glorious bodies and be established in this place and turned loose to enjoy this world in the way that Adam was turned loose to enjoy it. Although we will get to enjoy it in a way that Adam could never have anticipated. So that's the gospel. Yeah, the gospel is about our forgiveness of sins. Yes, it's about his blood being shed that we could enjoy this place eventually, right? But it's a much bigger picture than that. It's a picture of God taking this whole thing and saying, this is the creature I created, and these are the complementary nature of these two beings, and I'm going to make perfect versions of that in Christ Jesus. So that's what we're looking forward to, see? That's what I'm looking forward to. I don't know what you're looking forward to, but I'm not looking forward to sitting on a cloud somewhere with a little harp and some wings and, you know. No, I'm looking forward to an earth. I'm looking forward to a day in which there is no sin, where there is no temptation. The devil's been cast away. The earth has been perfected. Our relationships with one another have been perfected. Our God is lighting this world by his very presence, and we get to go and enjoy it all. Dive to the deepest sea, climb the highest mountain, travel off this planet to whatever else God has created out there to enjoy.
Forever.
And to and more importantly, to enjoy him in that place forever. Just as Adam had a relationship with God, thus we will have a perfect relationship with God. So imagine a world where you have a perfect relationship with your Creator to be able to enjoy all he's created.
Yeah.
But that's what we're promised in the gospel of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. To understand the gospel, you have to have a right worldview.